I think I read in your own bio that you call yourself a lapsed Australian.
Yeah, it's funny because when I go back to Australia, you know, because I grew up there, my father's American, but my mother's Australian. So I often have comments about this weird hybrid accent that I've developed. they're trying to work it out. And, you know, I don't have any great answers for them other than that I've spent, you know, 22 of the last 25 years in the States. So that's part of it.
Well, I can hear a little bit of it in there.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on the new book, Dominic. It's as beautiful as I expected it to be. I fell in love with your first book, and what you do so well, and you're still doing it, and even better, if that's possible. Yeah,
I appreciate that.
While we're still on the topic of Australia a little bit, are you doing a book tour there as well?
I am, yes. So the book is coming out there with Alan and Unwin, and it'll come out in May. And so I did some early book PR just on this previous trip a week ago. And then I'm going to go back out in August for a book festival. And I'm going to do an event at the Art Gallery of New South Wales.
Any plans on coming up to Michigan?
No immediate plans, but I'm always open to invitations. So spread the word.
All right. I will.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate that.
Dominic, give us a quick synopsis for those who haven't read the book yet. Give us an appetizer, a temptation to read this book. What is it about?
Sure. Yeah. So The Last Painting of Sarah DeVos follows a single 17th century Dutch painting through time. And it looks at how it impacts three different lives in three different centuries. So we follow Sarah DeVos, who's the first woman to be admitted to a Guild of St. Luke in 17th century Holland, and that's kind of the Painter's Guild. We follow a wealthy Manhattan lawyer in 1950s New York who inherits this landscape painting by DeVos and then also has it stolen. And then finally, we follow a woman named Ellie Shipley, who becomes a fairly celebrated art historian. But when she was a struggling graduate student at Columbia, she was paid to make a copy of this this landscape. And so years later, when she's curating an exhibition for the Art Gallery of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, both her copy and the original show up for the same exhibit. And that kind of threatens to unravel, you know, her personal and her professional life.
I was looking at book page online, and they referred to something called a flurry of fiction focused on the art world. Maybe you can tell us about how the idea for the book came
Sure.
around, and was it because of any kind of flurry that you saw out there?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if there has been a flurry. I mean, certainly we can think of, you know, of books about painters, but I think that that goes way back. I think writers have always been interested in artists. You know, even if you think back to something like, you know, the picture of Dorian Gray, or some of the French novelists. But for me, I mean, this was a novel that was kind of in the making 15 years ago. I was living in Amsterdam, and, you know, like a lot of art lovers, I was initially drawn to the iconic images of the Dutch Golden Age, so the Vermeers and Rembrandts, the Frans Hals paintings, the Van Goyens. And I often think of these as the kind of prize fighters of the Dutch Golden Age, but they're actually just really the very tip of the iceberg. I mean, there are these additional layers of the Dutch Golden Age that are really interesting to me, and some of them are missing in a sense. So there were about 25 women admitted to a Guild of St. Luke in the 17th century in Holland, and we only have surviving works for a small handful of them. So, for example, Judith Leister disappeared for 200 years. All of her paintings were attributed to either Frans Hals or her husband, who was also a painter. And then she was rediscovered in 1892 and kind of put back on the map. Today she has some 35 paintings to her name. So this book really came out of, in a sense, the gaps and the silences in art history. And I got very interested in that, and it kind of built over time, the idea developed.
Tell us a little bit more about those who aren't deep into the art world. How did the guilds operate?
Yeah. So I often think of the guilds of St. Luke as kind of the ultimate, you know, buy local program because they were, in a sense, you know, for the rights of the local artists. So if you were an artist of any kind, in a city in the Netherlands in the 17th century, you had to belong to a guild to do it professionally. So they really governed how work was created, who could sign a work in the case of paintings. They often had to pay taxes to the city on behalf of their members. So there was this, you know, it was a guild in a couple different ways. They mobilized artists around particular issues of the time. But they also, in some regards, had a fairly paternalistic attitude towards their members and were, you know, pretty far-reaching. So if you sold a painting illegally and you were a member of the guild, and let's say you sold a painting at an outdoor market or something like that, you could be fined or you could even lose your membership in the guild. So they're fairly far-reaching.
And forgery, that's a very big part of what this novel is about. And I was intrigued. I think I know a reasonable amount about the arts. My own father is a painter, so I grew up with the smell of turpentine. But of course, he was doing his own art, not forgery.
Yeah.
I was intrigued when I read this novel about, you know, it, and of course it clicked as I'm reading it. Oh, it's a lot more than just painting a picture. There's other ways that you have to show the passage of time. Yeah. And I understand you worked with a master forger.
I did on a limited basis. I read this memoir that was fantastic by the master forger Ken Perenni. He published this book called Caveat Emptor, and I read that while I was writing the book. Got fascinated and emailed him at one point. And actually, you know, one of the stranger moments of this book, it was emailing a master forger to have him authenticate a painting that was by, you know, a fictitious character. And, you know, but he was actually very willing and quite forthcoming. And he showed me some of the mistakes in the forgery technique that I was using. But what was really one of the things I learned from Perenni's memoir in particular is that at least 50% of what a forger does is really not about the technical aspect of the painting, let's say. So it almost has to do with the narrative or the storytelling side of it. So he would use techniques like putting, you know, blue chalk marks on the back of a painting to suggest previous auction sales. He would create, you know, fake fly specks to suggest on a painting that it had, you know, languished in an attic for years because flies are drawn to, you know, the varnish, the sugars in the varnish on old paintings. So all these things in a way are about creating, in a way, the suspension of disbelief. And a lot of what a forger does is around that. And so when I went back and read about other forgers, I discovered, of course, that they have all done this through time. They've created a story that goes with the painting. And that seemed to be a very important part of this novel and of the forgery practice.
When you decided to create this fictional painting, tell me about that process. I mean, why choose, well, it was called At the Edge of a Wood. Why did you choose the scene that you chose? What inspired you?
Yeah, so what inspired me was this kind of anomaly in Dutch art history, which is, you know, we have these missing women painters of the guild, but there are no landscapes by, there's not a landscape by a single Dutch woman in the entire 17th century. There are various answers and, you know, theories as to why. One theory is that, you know, women had a very domestic role and it wasn't their place to be out of doors for hours, you know, working on a landscape. But there are other suggestions that that's not quite accurate. There was an artist at the end of the 17th century named Maria Sibylla Merriam, and she basically left her estranged husband, took her daughter, and moved to Suriname in South America for 2 years and worked on botanical sketches. So, you know, I think it's maybe oversimplifying to suggest that, you know, the reason we haven't found any landscapes is because women strictly didn't paint them. So my novel really, part of the conceit is to imagine the circumstances under which a woman might have painted a landscape that has a particular meaning for her as a painter, and that changes, you know, meanings over time as it's handed down, in this case, through one family for centuries.
And what did you discover about the world of forgery today? Is there this entire underworld out there?
I think there's, you know, there's definitely an underworld. And I think that underworld has actually been around since the beginning of art. I think forgery has always been there. What's changing, I think, is a few things. One is museums especially are getting incredibly sophisticated with their technology. So it's very hard to really, if it's given the right analysis, to pull off a forgery of, you know, certainly an iconic painting. And then the other thing that's changing is museums' attitude towards forgery. And so for really years, centuries, let's say, museums basically pretended as if forgery didn't exist. And it was never mentioned. And if a forgery were discovered in their collection, they would quietly take it down. But really, they didn't really ever talk about it. So that's starting to change. And in fact, some museums, like the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, has a fake on display. There was a famous Dutch forger during World War II, Van Meegeren, who faked a Vermeer or several Vermeers and sold them to the Nazis and to Goering. And that, in a way, is celebrated, and his fake is on display. And even museums here in the U.S. are starting to occasionally exhibit fakes and talk about them, and it's coming out of the shadows. And I think what they're discovering is that while it threatens one of the key value drivers in the museum world, which is authenticity, it also is this source of fascination for the public. So they're adjusting their attitude towards it a little.
And as I read the book, I have to say I've really admired this artist, and I'm calling her an artist, her talent, her skill, all that went into it. Almost, you could say, an added set of skills beyond what the painter would have, giving it that time. So is it an art form of its own? Is it respected in some kind of a way? I mean, I feel like it should be.
I think it is. I think it is respected, but begrudgingly. I think what's interesting is that forgers, if you read, there's some really interesting, you know, what I think of as forgery manifestos, these books by frustrated, extremely talented artists who've turned to forgery over time. One of them was Eric Hebborn, who wrote this book called The Art Forger's Handbook, who died very mysteriously in Rome, I think maybe in the 90s, maybe earlier. But I think, you know, there is a respect for the sheer bravado, the talent, the technical skill. I mean, like you say, you know, the forgery in the book, there's the one side, which is, you know, creating the illusion and creating the technical feat. But also the artist has to kind of have a forensic mind. They have to be able to look at a painting, let's say, of the 17th century and work out, how do I achieve that effect? And forgers are incredibly ingenious when it comes to that. Van Meegeren, when he was painting his fake Vermeers, he had the problem, which is that oil pigments take at least 50 years to fully harden. And sometimes what a buyer will do they'll use a pin to test the, you know, the softness of the oil paints. And so what he did is he added Bakelite to his pigments to harden them, and used a pizza oven to basically, you know, bake them at 100 degrees. And they would give the effect of fully hardened oil paint. So, you know, there is a kind of genius in those really great, you know, feats of forgery. But I think it's different than the kind of genius that goes into, you know, original art forms. But it's something that I think the art world struggles with.
Do you think forgers are motivated just by money, or is there another element of motivation that drives them?
I think they're driven by the need for recognition. And what's ironic is that they often make quite a bit of money. Ken Perini, for example, made a lot of money with his forgeries. He interestingly waited for the statute of limitations to run out on his crimes. He stopped forging, before he wrote his, you know, really interesting memoir. But they do have, you know, they have a set of skills that are that they have to keep honed, and I think they ultimately want recognition beyond the anonymous recognition that happens when someone buys your forged Van Gogh or whatever it is.
Well, that's why I'm wondering. They don't really get the recognition when they're a forger.
No, not unless they do what Perini did and actually write about it. And I think in a way, they want to tell their story. And so often you find these narratives from forgers who've stopped doing it, but really confess at some point to, you know, their crimes, and they kind of they give you some insight. There's also an interesting forger. The New Yorker did a profile of this guy named Mark Landis, I think last year. And what's interesting about him is he has this compulsion to create fake art, but then he doesn't sell it. He donates it to museums. And you can imagine what kind
donates
of...
Donates them as originals, quote unquote?
Yes, yeah, exactly. So he donates them, and what he does is he invents a story around how he came by this. But they're quite accomplished. But, you know, there it's a compulsion. It's a desire for recognition, even though it's not the kind of recognition that the artist who creating an original work is looking for.
Do you paint yourself at all?
I don't. I have very little artistic talent. I did briefly study architecture in my early undergrad days, but that was about as close as I got to the art world.
So when you were looking into writing this book, did you spend a lot of time in museums?
I did. I spent a lot of time in museums. I also was very lucky to work with a couple art experts. So a woman named Freema Fox Hofrichter, who spent her life and career as an art historian studying Judith Leister, taught me a lot about, you know, the lives of women in the 17th century as painters. And then also a guy named Stephen Gritt, who's the head of restoration for the National Gallery of Canada. He taught me a lot about the way that the Dutch built their paintings and how the layering, you can kind of think of the layers in a Dutch painting almost in geological terms. So restorers have to really know that geology very in depth in order to, you know, build up a loss in a painting or, you know, fix something that's, you know, threatening the work over time. So I got a lot of help from really one of my great loves as a novelist is to be able to engage with subject matter experts and pick their brains and try to see the world the way that they see it.
Now, these lost women painters of the Dutch Golden Age, along with Judith Leister, who was your model for this character, mm-hmm. were there others whose stories really struck you that you might share?
Yeah, I mean, actually, so the one that really stood out for me is the one we know the least about, and that's this woman named Sarah van Balbergen. So she was in the same guild as Judith Leister. Judith Leister, I think, was admitted to the Haarlem Guild in 1633, and Sarah was admitted about 2 years before her. But all we know about her is that she was an oil painter. She was admitted to the guild, and that's about it. None of her work has either survived or been correctly attributed. But I think what historians are realizing is that, you know, number one, there can be all kinds of misattribution that happens over time. Leister is a great example of that. And number two, there's a huge volume of Dutch Golden Age painting that we just don't know anything about the biography of the painters who've signed the work. So, you know, there were estimated to be about some 50,000 Dutch painters at work in the 17th century, and they created millions of works of art. And the estimate is only 1% has survived, but that's still, you know, tens of thousands of pieces of art. And we just know very little about the lives of many or most of those artists.
You know, when I was reading this, too, I had to think about all these theories that surface from time to time that William Shakespeare was actually a woman and something of that happening here in your book, too. I wonder how many artists have put their names on paintings that women actually painted?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. I mean, and the painting in question for Judith Leister, you know, it was this painting called The Carousing Couple, and it was thought to be very typical Franz Hals. It's a man and a woman in a tavern. The woman's raising a glass to the man. The man's playing the violin. And the buyer, the reason it was discovered, there was this court case, and the buyer discovered this monogram below the violinist's shoe. So here's this painting that he assumed, and for 100 years everyone thought was by Franz Hals. It had this little monogram which had a capital J and a capital L and a star struck through it. Of course, that turned out to be Judith Leicester's monogram, because star in Dutch is the word Leicester. Mm. And so it was this visual pun on her name. And so it wasn't signed by Franz Hals, but in a way, no one was looking for this monogram that was actually in plain sight. So, it, you know, in some ways, there are the paintings that have been signed incorrectly. Then there are paintings that are actually signed by the right person, but people tend to ignore it if it's a name that they don't recognize.
In an essay you've written, you mentioned something about novelists are like forgers.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I mean by that is that, like forgers, we deal in inventions, in figments. You know, we create things out of nothing, and we're trying to emulate something, you know, about experience, about the world. We're not the same in the sense that we're copying, but we are sometimes working in some of the same shadows. And, you know, that was interesting to me as I was working on the novel, to think about the way that a forger works, the way that a painter works, and the way that a novelist works. And there's perhaps more in common in just the day-to-day methods, the hours spent alone, the kinds of research that maybe we've at first think.
And to finish this and wrap it up, Dominic, I would love to hear a short excerpt from, so that we can get a little flavor of how you do your forgery.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to read my forgery of this landscape called At the Edge of a Wood. So this is the description of the painting by Sarah DeVos that opens the novel. A winter scene at twilight. The girl stands in the foreground against a silver birch, a pale hand pressed to its bark, staring out at the skaters on the frozen river. There are half a dozen of them bundled against the cold, flecks of brown and yellow cloth floating above the ice. A brindled dog trots beside a boy as he arcs into a wide turn. One mitten in the air, he's beckoning to the girl, to us. Up along the riverbank, a village is drowsy with smoke and firelight, flush against the bell of the pewter sky. A single cataract of daylight at the horizon, a meadow dazzled beneath a rent in the clouds, then the revelation of her bare feet in the snow. A raven, quilled in violet and faintly iridescent, caws from a branch beside her. In one hand she holds a frayed black ribbon, twined between slender fingers, and the hem of her dress, visible beneath a long gray shawl, is torn. The girl's face is mostly in profile, her dark hair loose and tangled about her shoulders. Her eyes are fixed on some distant point, but is it dread, or the strange halo of winter twilight that pins her in place? She seems unable or unwilling to reach the frozen riverbank. Her footprints lead back through the snow toward the wood beyond the frame. Somehow, she's walked into this scene from outside the painting, trudged onto the canvas from our world, not hers.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dominic. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks so much for having me.